TED Audio Collective.
Got a business problem? There's a TED Talk for that. Stay updated on everything business on TED Business, a podcast hosted by Columbia Business School professor Modupe Akinola. Every week, she'll introduce you to leaders with unique insights on work, answering questions like, how do four-day work weeks work? Will a machine ever take my job? Get some surprising answers on TED Business, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, everyone. It's Adam Grant. Welcome back to Rethinking, my podcast on the science of what makes us tick with the TED Audio Collective. I'm an organizational psychologist, and I'm taking you inside the minds of fascinating people to explore new thoughts and new ways of thinking. My guest today is Charan Ranganath, a psychologist and neuroscientist who directs the Dynamic Memory Lab at the University of California, Davis. Are you a forgetful person?
I am a very forgetful person. I know that I am the prototypical absent-minded professor, and so I do have a lot of problems with memory. And so it's probably a reason why I'm interested in the prefrontal cortex as a result.
He's a Guggenheim Fellow and the author of the new book, Why We Remember. And he's about to turn some of your assumptions about memory upside down. How did you get interested in memory?
I took a class from Danny Kahneman, and Danny, at that time, you know, wasn't like the Nobel Prize winner, but, you know, he was just still as charismatic and smart as ever. And so he was talking a lot about decision-making and how people can be irrational. But a lot of what the work was about is really about how memory leads people to make decisions that are irrational. Then later on, I go to grad school and I'm actually working in clinical psychology, but a lot of that clinical work is seeing patients and testing them for brain damage. And no matter what was wrong with them, like 9 times out of 10, they came in saying they had a problem with their memory, or worse, a relative would bring them in and say they had a problem with their memory. And the range of things that people were having problems with could be clinical depression, it could be multiple sclerosis, it could be, of course, early Alzheimer's disease. But memory was affected in almost everything. And then when I was doing my therapy work in the clinic, I was doing cognitive behavior therapy, but a lot of that is addressing people's beliefs. And in that process of digging into people's beliefs and being curious about it, as opposed to saying, well, you just have dysfunctional beliefs, you end up getting into the world of memory and you end up finding out how people arrived at these things. And sometimes you'd end up with these really idiosyncratic stories. In the book, I talk about my first therapy patient who had a driving phobia. And we actually worked behavior therapy on the driving part of it, but he didn't feel like he was done. And we eventually got into it, and he was revealed that he had had this big, you know, he was gay, and he came out to his father and got into a big fight with him right before he went out and got into a car accident and got rear-ended by someone. And so did that cause him to have a phobia? I don't know, but it was really important for him to share that story. And so all these things kind of came together in my mind of how important memory was. And then at the time, brain imaging was just taking off. And we had this unprecedented opportunity to change the way we understand memory, because so much of the thinking in the clinic was based on ideas that had come out, you know, decades before. And there was really this opportunity to change the way we think about it. And so I decided to rethink my career direction and hopped away from what would have been probably a lucrative career in clinical psychology, and instead just jumped on the chance to do some actual neuroscience research.
I was stunned that we're wrong about the fundamental function of memory, that the point of memory is not to be able to recall the past, which just sounds so counterintuitive. Talk to me a little bit about why, in fact, my memory is not about remembering.
If you just take the most basic finding in memory research, like go back to when people first started quantifying memory, one of the things that we know is that people forget most of what they've tried very, very hard to learn. People forget that within 24 hours. And to this day, no one has been reported as just somebody who can truly remember everything. There are people who remember a lot of detail about certain aspects of their experiences, but nobody remembers everything. So right off the bat, we know that the expectation that we're supposed to remember everything from our past is just wrong, right? So then you ask yourself, okay, well, what is memory for? And, you know, because by definition, if something is in the past, it's over with. So from an evolutionary perspective, why should you even care about it? And the answer is, of course, because some of the things that we remember from our past are useful in the present and the future. And more, as my career started to get in deeper and deeper in memory, I became less and less interested about seeing what goes on in terms of recording the past and more about how we use memory in the here and now and how memory is used to anticipate what could happen in the future, to generate predictions and plan and so forth. And if you see people who have a memory problem, the reason why they're so upset by that, the reason why it just gets to the core of them, is in part because you can't function with a memory problem. And you can't function because you're constantly getting lost in the middle of conversations. You're physically getting lost when you're trying to move from place to place. You feel mentally disconnected in time and space. Imagination, planning, you're kind of stuck in this present time. And there's some positives to that we can get into, but there's a lot, it's deeply disturbing too.
One of the things your work has left me wondering is forgetting actually a good thing? Or is it sometimes a useful thing?
I would definitely say the answer is yes. And I think most scientists in the field of memory would agree. As long as you're remembering the right things or the things that you need, forgetting is good. And the analogy I give is that as we've done more computer models of memory, where we've tried to figure out, reverse engineer the brain, one of the things that you start to realize very, very quickly is there are design principles. I think our brains are designed for quality over quantity. And you could see this in the brain from the most basic level of, I feel like I'm seeing everything in front of me, but really I'm only attending to a small proportion of what's actually out there. And the parts that I'm attending to when I'm moving my eyes all over the place, I'm getting high resolution, but little chunks of the world. And I'm using my knowledge and I'm using what's happening in the present and putting it all together into a picture in my mind of what's in front of me, right? And so right off the bat, we're saying, hey, we get a little bit of information, but it's as high quality as possible. And then we use that economically to get meaning and to really generate information about what's useful. So kind of a long answer to your question, but yes, I think forgetting is a very useful part of that because there's so much that we don't want to haul around.
Well, I think higher on that list of things we would like to forget are, you know, our unpleasant memories, embarrassing moments, for example. And I want to talk in part in our conversation about how to improve our memory, but you're making me wonder about how to improve our forgetting. So maybe let me give you an anecdote that I think captures a little bit of my curiosity around this. I remember in my first year of grad school, I had a classmate who was enamored with some work done by an eminent psychologist, Dick Nisbet. Mm. And she read four or five of his papers. They'd been published about a decade earlier. And she got a meeting with him. She sat down and she started asking him questions about the papers. And he gave her this blank look. And he couldn't answer any of her questions. And finally, she said, well, you know, I really wanted to talk to you about this body of work. And he said, oh, that finished 8 years ago. I've purged it from my memory. And I was so troubled by the idea that you could actively purge something from your memory. It never occurred to me that you could intentionally forget something. So is this a thing? Can you do it? If so, how?
Yes, it is a thing. How big of an effect it is in the real world, we don't know. One of my friends and colleagues, Mike Anderson, who's now in Cambridge, has basically made his career studying this, and he's very passionate about this idea of voluntary forgetting. And he's got a good body of evidence to show that that same kind of control that we can exert to inhibit, say, a movement, we can inhibit the retrieval of a memory. And so the question is how big of an effect that is and how permanent it is. But it's definitely been shown that you can inhibit the recovery of a memory and make it harder to access and maybe even change it to make it blurrier.
So how does this inhibition work? If I wanted to forget a memory, how would I do it?
Well, according to Mike's research, it's literally as easy as telling people, don't think about it. There is a school of thought that says if I tell you not to think about something, you will actually think about it.
Yeah, I'm immediately thinking about the Dan Wegner work on the white bear effect and the ironic effects of thought suppression. So you tell me not to think about something and it becomes more active in my mind.
It's not like he's just saying, never think about this terrible memory, but you're sort of like actually kind of getting people in the process of retrieving and then squashing that process. That's a big theme that connects many, many areas of memory research is the act of remembering in and of itself changes the memory in certain ways. And you can inhibit it to kind of squash it, especially squash some of the details, or you could enhance it and make it more accessible later on. So you might find that a story that you tell once or twice, it's just easy. It comes to mind so much easier the more you tell that story, right? And so that's a case where recovering a memory can actually strengthen it. You can also modify it. And so maybe the more times you tell the story, you embellish it here, you embellish it there, and then it becomes hard to tell the difference between the original thing that happened and all these embellishments that you threw in for different audiences.
Well, and I think this is why people often run into trouble with stories they've retold over and over over a period of years. They haven't realized how the story has morphed as it's been recalled.
There's work on what's called audience tuning effects. I've got a memory, but I shape the perspective of that memory so that we can come to kind of some common ground. Then you tell me something back. And through this interaction, that's no longer my unique experience. It's our experience. And a little bit of you is being injected back into this memory again, right? And so what happens is then we tell these stories to different people and we tune them up to different audiences. And then they react. And that changes the way we think about that memory. In some cases, it can lead to some real distortions and introduce all this new junk into it. But one of the positive sides is it can really change your perspective. You know, one of my favorite quotes from Star Wars is Ben Kenobi says, many of the truths we cling to depend on our own perspectives. It really is true that we often confuse the data in memory, that is the little bits that come up that are representative of what happened, with the theory that we generate, which we use to say, well, what really happened? And that story is heavily influenced by perspective. And this is one thing super powerful about psychotherapy in the clinic is that's what a therapist should be there for. It's not just to say, oh, I totally agree with you, but to listen to you and reflect back from an alternate perspective, or maybe just encourage you to rethink from an alternate perspective.
We're not just helping you process the memory, we're actually reconstructing it.
When many scientists have looked at brain activity, when people recall past events that they've experienced, it actually looks remarkably similar to things that they imagine that could happen in the future. And there's a whole line of research that's just fascinating about how hard it is for people to tell the difference between memory and imagination, even.
I read some research recently suggesting that when people recalled traumatic memories, it activated neural networks associated with current experience. People were almost reliving them. As opposed to recalling them. Talk to me about that.
So sometimes what happens is people get this feeling that's so strong, they feel like they're reliving the event, even though many of the details are actually missing. And that doesn't mean it's a wrong memory. It just means that our feeling of re-experiencing is so often tied to that visceral playback as opposed to the actual information content.
Let's talk about how to improve memory. My basic read of a couple decades of memory research as an outsider is if you want to remember something you read, you should not spend all this time rereading it or highlighting it. Instead, what you want to do is let it consolidate by taking a break, ideally in a quiet place. Quiz yourself so that you can identify what you remember and what the gaps are. And then retrieve it repeatedly to make it stick. I like to do that by sharing it, telling somebody else about it, so that there's now like there's an interaction or an exchange that it's part of. How does that track with the science, and what am I missing?
there are different tricks for remembering different kinds of things. So the trick that you might use for memorizing someone's name might not be the trick that you use for memorizing Spanish vocabulary words or something like that, right? So that's just a little bit of a kind of a disclaimer. But a lot of the things that you brought up are kind of something that I would subsume under the term error-driven learning. When we are struggling to learn something, you're actually going to retain that information better than if you're not. You know, spacing out your learning experiences, testing yourself, all of these different kinds of techniques, you're basically putting a stress test on the thing that you initially learned. And so in our computer model, what happens is that every time you recall something, you relearn it, right? That's a new way of reshaping the memory. And so what happens in our computer models is you actually reshape some of the connections involved in that memory so that you remove some of the weak parts of the trace and you add some of the good parts, you just reinforce those. And so it's just more accessible later on. On one hand, this is counterintuitive because it's like, well, surely giving yourself the right answer, just memorizing it over and over, should be better than producing a wrong answer and then correcting yourself. But I mean, nobody who's like rehearsing for a play just reads the lines over and over and over again and then says, okay, I'm going to do it perfectly when I go on stage, right? It's you actually give yourself the chance to screw up the lines and then go back and you figure it out, right? It doesn't have to be making a mistake. It's really revealing the weaknesses in your memory and then going back and repairing those weaknesses.
That definitely resonates. So let's take a personal example here. When I first started teaching, I was teaching a week-long intensive course, and I had about 225 students across three different sections. And there was no way I was going to get to have a meaningful personal interaction with every one of them. But I wanted to make it clear that I cared about getting to know them. So before the first day of class, I memorized all their names and had them put their name cards down. And then I went around the room and named them. And it was pretty time-consuming to memorize all the names with all the faces, adding the layer of some people didn't look like their pictures. And also, I had three different students at different times of day sitting in the same seat, and sometimes I would mix them up. So I think the first time I did it, I got all the students right in one room of 75, but I missed a couple in another. And I'm curious about how I can improve. My basic memory technique was I would go through and basically memorize five names and just repeat kind of the name in order over and over again. And then I would quiz myself on those five. And then once I got it, I'd add more and kind of brute force it. And I got some advice that I should try the Memory Palace, which I haven't. I'm curious to get your reactions and recommendations. What do you think of my technique and how could I make it more efficient and also more effective?
First of all, I do like the technique and I admire your willingness to go through that trouble because it's like you are going to have some forgetting and you're revealing those weaknesses.
Well, actually, this is one of the memories I want to forget is when I called a student by the wrong name. This is 15 years ago and it still bothers me.
Well,
and,
you know, so
and to your point, I still remember that student's name.
Exactly, right?
Michael, so, I'm really sorry.
Well, so to be fair, you probably met a lot of people named Michael, right? And so it's not that you can't remember the name Michael. It's that you can't associate it with that face because that name has been attached to so many other people you probably met and know, right? The Memory Palace is kind of a fancy way for those people who might not know it. It's basically like saying, take a place that you know very well, like your childhood home or something like that. Or you could make it up and create a little palace in your head. But if you take like your childhood home or something like that, and you imagine, okay, I'm going to take Michael and I'm going to visualize Michael in room number one. And then I'm going to walk over to room number two and say, okay, I'm going to visualize Harriet in room number two. So you go around like that. And so what happens is just by virtue of taking advantage of that structure that you know, this place, and putting these things that you're trying to memorize in different places, you can restrict the degree to which these memories compete with each other, and you give yourself an access point that allows you to reach them again. That's one way of doing it. I don't particularly like that way for things like names and faces, though, because I feel like that's better for memorizing kind of arbitrary things that have no meaning. You know, I think for someone like you, if you're going through the trouble of memorizing each person's name, it's because you want to get to know these people, right? And so what I would suggest is you get a fun fact about them, or you get something like biographical about them that's meaningful. One of the weird things about memory is if you give people more things to memorize, they're typically bad at it. But if you can make all those things play well together, now it gives you something that it's easier to remember. So for instance, it's like if I had just met you on the street and I knew nothing about you, it would be really hard for me to remember your name and face, right? But I've heard a lot of your stuff talking previously, and I've seen, you know, and read stuff. And so it's like coming here, I already had a schema, so to speak, I already had knowledge. And so all I have to do is tack on your facial details to that knowledge that I already had. And it's much easier, you know. And so the more you can get some kind of a unique factoid about the person, some kind of knowledge that you can tack it onto, it's no longer an arbitrary piece of information. Recommendation two would be repeat the name once just to make sure you got it. Then randomly revisit that name later on. So you space out those attempts that you had. So it's like rather than saying Michael, okay, Michael, let me move on. I would go two or three to, you know, go back, go through the entire list and then start revisiting these people again and saying, okay, so I know I probably have already lost some of these names. And so, you know, I'm just going to try again. So you, and do it in a different order so that it's kind of random. But the more you space out these attempts, what happens is your brain's going to struggle more and more because the time between those things has passed. And so you have to change the memory more each time. And at least in our simulations, when we simulate this in computer models of the brain, what happens is you start to cut out the things that are specific to seeing Michael at this time in this place. And it becomes more just about him as opposed to this one moment in time when you heard his name.
It's a little different from what I've done historically, which is I've done spaced retrieval more. I'd finish memorizing a whole class and then I'd put it away for half an hour and then I'd come back to it. And you're saying I can actually do that even within the class.
And I think also giving yourself that chance to make mistakes, people often blow that chance because once they go, oh, I couldn't remember the name, they go off to the races in their head. And rather than giving themselves the opportunity to just solidify that memory or even go further and be more curious and kind of get more knowledge about that you can use to kind of repair that memory.
This is very familiar for me. I've always been good at remembering facts and details about people, but not where I parked my car.
Mm.
I actually once was wandering in a parking garage for 2 hours because I lost my car. We did a work life episode a few years ago on how to remember anything, and Josh Foer was one of the guests, and we talked a lot about his process of becoming a memory champion.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I came away from that discussion really appreciating the importance of place in memory, which is something you were stressing a moment ago as well.
Yeah.
And I don't think I fully got it until I landed at O'Hare Airport. Have you been there?
Yeah.
Were you there when they gave every floor a sports team?
Yeah.
It was so helpful. Like, I immediately remembered that I parked on the Chicago Bulls level.
Yeah.
And I can picture Michael Jordan, and I don't need to write it down.
Yeah.
And it made me wonder why, first of all, why does every airport not do this? Second of all, why is the world organized to make it harder to remember things?
That's a great question. I suspect it's because people just assume it should be easy. There's this overconfidence that they have that if you fail to remember something, it's your fault. It's like parking your car, there's so much competition there that it's like your memory is being eaten alive by all these different other memories that are fighting to get out there. And so as a result, it's just really a very hard problem. And I think a lot of what goes on is institutions and people don't appreciate the difficulty of that problem. But getting back to this kind of institutional thing, it's really interesting. And I think it speaks to this question of how much I look back on education and our attitudes about education. And again, it's so much of like we grade people on how good they are as opposed to how much they've learned. And I think that's such a wrong attitude to have, that it's like this kind of the idea that somehow learning should be effortless. And if you're putting effort into it, that's because you're not smart or something, which is just like absolutely absurd. I always tell my students, if you don't have an imposter complex, you're probably not working hard enough. And what I mean by that is that it's like, if you don't feel like you're outside of your comfort zone, you're probably not learning enough. And for me, in my field, if you're not learning, what's the point of being a scientist?
Okay, this is a good time for the lightning round. What is the worst memory advice that people give and receive?
Yeah. Probably the biggest bad advice, I would say, is people saying that you should try to repeat things over and over again in your head, and that's a good way of memorizing. And then lifestyle-wise, trying to go for like multivitamins do have some good effects, but just in general, searching for supplements and crossword puzzles to improve your memory as opposed to bigger lifestyle changes you can make.
Do you have a favorite memory movie? My runaway first pick is Memento.
My runaway first pick is also Memento. It was just the best memory movie of all time. But I will say my favorite memory TV show now is Severance, because Severance
so
is just
good.
The deepest meditation on the mind, memory, and identity that I've ever seen. Just this idea that people could be in a workplace and divorced from all their memories outside of this workplace, and they are different people because they're trapped in this context, and that context dictates their sense of who they are, and it dictates what they can remember. And it's just this fascinating idea of like how, because we have these things in our head anyway that are these contexts that sort of block off what we can remember and what we can't. And so, yeah, I just love that show.
I thought the season finale, season one, was probably the best season finale I've ever seen of a show. And it did shatter some of what we typically think about the normal segmentation of life domains. My colleague Nancy Rothbard has consistently found that if you're somebody who likes to segment work and life and maintain a border between them, you tend to be happier than if you're an integrator who's constantly blurring boundaries. I think Severance took that too far.
My parents are both just having a difficult time transitioning into retiring, but they're transitioning. And the difficult part for them is it is kind of a death. You know, it is such a change in life that you're letting go of that context in your life. You know, of course, it's not really gone because they even had the severance procedure, but it's just this fascinating idea of how if you lose a memory for something, it's as if this part of you has died.
This also reminds me of another classic Dan Wegner finding around transactive memory, that one of the reasons breakups are so hard on people is that you've outsourced some of your memory to your partner, and they've literally walked away with some of your memories and also your ability to recall, like, okay, how do I pay those bills? And where exactly is this location that I don't ever drive to? And it seems like somebody literally walking out of your life, also taking part of your memory, ends up stealing some of your identity.
Yeah. And it's like there's always something there to remind you. The most mundane things that you'd be doing now are reminders of what's missing from your life.
The thing that drives everyone I know crazy about memory is the tip of the tongue phenomenon.
Mm.
You had something, you were about to say it, and you've just lost it.
Mm.
Can you give us any guidance for how to solve that problem when you run into it?
There's a number of different causes for why that happens, but one big one is you get stuck on the wrong answer. Because we have these biases to keep producing what's easy, once you get the wrong answer, your brain is kind of primed to keep producing the wrong answer, and you have to overcome that. And so sometimes changing your context and just changing the subject and saying, I'll get back to it, it'll come to me, is the best thing you can do, because once you then go back, you're no longer primed to keep pulling out that wrong answer.
What is the question you have for me?
What is the latest thing that aroused your curiosity?
Earlier today, I was running on the treadmill. I opened up Netflix and it recommended Breaking Bad. And all of a sudden, I found myself wondering for the first time, why does everyone love this show? What is it? And I'm now an episode in, and I totally get it. Late to that party. I learned that it's fascinating to watch a good person do a bad thing. And the opposite is probably true, too. and that it's also interesting to watch someone change right before your eyes.
One of the things we find is that when people's curiosity is triggered, you can actually boost the ability to learn and retain things that are happening in the moment. So we found when we look at areas of the brain that are involved in processing reward information and actually processing dopamine, the neuromodulator, what we find is that those areas activate in proportion with not getting an answer to a question, but getting the question itself and getting that boost of curiosity. And what's really cool is we have this job where we're constantly confronted with things that challenge us. And it's that gap, the prediction error is what we call it scientifically, but it's really the gap between what you thought you knew and what you're actually confronted with that can trigger a lot of those feelings of curiosity. And what happens is it energizes you and it gives you this itch of like, I got to get more information. But what's fascinating is I also find it's uncomfortable. I hear this all the time in scientific discussions where somebody hears something, and if there is a truly new idea or something that's truly different than the norm, half the people say, well, it must be wrong, and half the people say, well, we already knew it.
I have long thought that when you share a finding and half the audience thinks it's completely counterintuitive and the other half thinks it's completely obvious, you're onto something intriguing. You reminded me a couple of minutes ago of George Lowenstein's work on curiosity gaps and how he and the Heath brothers describe this gap between what you currently know and what you want to know as like an itch that you have to scratch. That's a great impetus for learning. It obviously makes things more memorable. I sometimes worry that we're creating those gaps inadvertently and sometimes in ways that are harmful. So the context that comes to mind immediately is when a judge says to a jury, disregard what you just heard. And I think to myself, well, aren't you drawing attention to that? And then aren't you also making the jury wonder, like, well, what is it about that that was problematic for me to hear? And then do they go and pay more attention to it? Is that a problematic instruction? Should we be approaching this differently? What would you say as a memory expert?
I think you're right that it's like if the first thing that may come to mind is this curiosity of, well, what's so bad about it that I can't actually remember it? And so I think without a reason, people may not be compliant because a lot of this is not about like what, you know, the message itself, but what people do with it. And that's like the story of memory for so long. I mean, behaviorism was all about people are just stimuli and responses. But since then, I think it's pretty clear. It's not about like laws of here's how you memorize things, but rather what you do with the instructions. That's super important.
So we want to tell judges to be really clear about why it's important to disregard.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, good.
And then say, don't think about it, right?
Well, you can't tell me what to think. I'll show you.
Yeah, exactly. But you don't want to think about this.
It's so easy now to outsource our memory to technological tools. How many people actually know their friends and family members' phone numbers anymore? Mm-hmm. How often do we know that we can run a Google search or now use a generative AI tool to look something up that we used to take pride in having stored in our own brains? I'm kind of in two minds about this. I think on the one hand, it seems like it frees up cognitive resources. On the other hand, I worry that like there's real knowledge lost. Where do you come down?
I think with most technology, just throughout the history of humankind, it doesn't come down so much to the technology, but how we interact with it, that's the issue. I'm a huge fan of outsourcing certain kinds of tedious memory tests to phones and devices, right? Because it's like, I don't have a photographic memory, but my phone literally does. So why not take a picture of where I parked my car as opposed to actually try to memorize it? But I think there's two ways in which we really hurt ourselves. We live in a culture of documenting things for social media. And so it's like you take pictures of things all the time and people will post it. And as soon as they post it, they never go back to the pictures. But the problem is when they were taking the pictures, they were never there in the first place, right? So you'll go to concerts and people will be like taking videos with their phones and they're just recording the whole thing mindlessly. But as a result, they're never there. And so they're depriving themselves of the ability to form a rich memory in the moment. And they're not even taking advantage of that reminder later on to kind of recall it over and over again. You can actually use photos in a way to help your memory by grabbing what's distinctive or unique about this time and using your focus on the moment of like, hey, this is curious, this is weird. Let me grab a picture of this, because those are the things that will be serve as great reminders later on. As much as we'd like to think the technology is really going to help and adapt to human thinking, I feel like humans are much more likely to adapt to the thinking of our technology. The brain is always trying to optimize and produce things more fluently and easily. And so even things that are just words or sentences will be more or less accessible just through certain kinds of repetition. We start to shape our language around what's suggested to us. And this is true with music too. You see like algorithms that feed us particular things, and it sort of deprives us of the opportunity of those weird experiences that we can have that opens us up to something really new.
You talked a minute ago about having novel experiences. And I think that speaks to something you captured that's really powerful about the pandemic. So there's this paradox when I think about 2020 and 2021, which is a lot of people felt like time stood still and they took forever, those 2 years. But also people can't remember a thing that happened during COVID. What's going on there?
It was fascinating because right around that time, we were studying this phenomenon in our lab called event boundaries. If you think about time, it moves continuously, right? But when we remember our experiences, we remember them in terms of events. So you remember a conversation that you had with somebody, not the word in the conversation that happened right before you walked out the door or whatever. Those event boundaries are kind of like the little organizers of our experience. Memory is all about having distinctive experiences. And just by virtue of our daily schedules in normal life, we go to different places. And that puts very big event, it's one of the biggest ways to create an event boundary. So what's interesting about the pandemic is we had the opposite. You're sitting in front of a screen all day, interacting with screens all day. You're in the same house. You are doing procedures that are very, very similar to each other. And so what happens is over the course of a day, it feels like your event boundaries have blurred into almost nothingness. And so there's a real value in changing your context, seeing different people going to different places, if nothing else, just to give you that distinctiveness in memory.
So that sounds like an antidote to the Groundhog Day effect.
My family, when I was growing up, we didn't take a lot of vacations. But, you know, in the last few years, I should say, I've really been very mindful of taking vacations with my family because I want to be able to look back on the last year and remember something. And, you know, I'm not going to remember all those hours I spent watching YouTube videos or, you know, sitting at my computer responding to emails. But I will remember those times where I truly changed context. I learned new things. I met new people. We spent time together in a new way outside of our normal context. And so that whole part of life has become much, much more important to me because, again, most of our decisions, most of our assessment of our lives and, you know, how good they were is not based on what we experienced, but what we remembered.
Can you give us some averages for how long it takes for a memory to fade? And then how often we'd want to retrieve it or practice or self-test in order for it to stick?
Yes. Ebbinghaus was the first scientist that really quantified how quickly we forget. And he actually measured forgetting by actually memorizing these really arbitrary, meaningless pieces of information. And then he would wait a certain amount of time, and then he would see, can I recall everything perfectly? And if not, how many study episodes does it take for me to relearn that information, right? Typically, in the Ebbinghaus forgetting curve, he was finding, even by this really generous measure, within about 24 hours, he was losing about 60% of what he learned, which is why I say so much of our experience is just doomed to be forgotten, right? If you're talking about the most meaningless information, like your parking place situation, another example, right? You typically get within like about 2 hours, I believe, you start to like lose about, you know, 40% of what was memorized before. So it's a very steep curve of forgetting, and then it starts to ease off over time. So definitely within that first day is when you're going to experience the most forgetting. And then after that starts to level off. So probably the best thing to do is, if you learn something in the morning, try to recall it again at night before you go to bed. And then, you know, when you wake up again, try to recall it. And so you're waiting for a lot of that forgetting to have taken place, but not for so much forgetting that you really are going to be at the point where you're not going to remember anything about it.
The final question that speaks to is, I think people are worried when they can't remember something that it's lost. And especially as they age, they get more and more concerned about that. Mm. And I think one of the takeaways of your work is that it's not necessarily gone from our memory in many cases. It's that we don't know how to retrieve it. Agree or disagree?
Agree, yeah. So I think the kind of subjective proof of this is listening to a song or smelling something or being back in a place that you haven't been like in a long time. And all of a sudden this thing comes back to you that you just didn't even think that memory existed until it just pops into your head, right? And so the advice I give for trying to find those memories is exactly that. Try to put yourself back in that context. What was happening in that moment in time? There's a lot of controversy in my field about how much is gone and how much can't be retrieved. And this is a big debate. And I'm sure there's memories that actually are gone, so to speak, or morphed in ways that are just completely unrecognizable. So for instance, the first 2 years of life, nobody really remembers anything. You can get it later on through looking at pictures and stuff and hearing stories, but nobody remembers those periods. So those definitely seem to be gone.
This has been really interesting and thought-provoking, and I would even say memorable. Although, if I forget this conversation, you're telling me that might not be the end of the world.
It might not be the end of the world because you'll still have some savings. And the next time you hear it, it'll be like, oh, that's a really good point.
Yes, but that's not going to happen because I'm going to think of you every time I watch Severance now.
It's a collective memory now.
If there's one idea from this conversation that you shouldn't forget, the primary purpose of remembering is not to document the past. It's to help you plan the future. Rethinking is hosted by me, Adam Grant. This show is part of the TED Audio Collective, and this episode was produced and mixed by Cosmic Standard. Our producers are Hannah Kingsley Ma and Asia Simpson. Our editor is Alejandra Salazar. Our fact checker is Paul Durbin. Original music by Hansdale Stew and Allison Leighton Brown. Our team includes Eliza Smith, Jacob Winnick, Samaya Adams, Michelle Quint, Banban Cheng, Julia Dickerson, and Whitney Pennington Rogers.
They had people text messaging. People couldn't tell the difference very often between a real human and the machine.
It reminds me of a paper that I read recently showing that a lot of people thought that if you wanted to convince another person that your text message was from a human, you should say love. But people were actually more persuaded by banana and poop. I think the test was you can only say one word that convinces the person on the other end that you're actually a human, not a computer. Nope, don't say love, banana poop.